620 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. This nice and mostly sunny Saturday. We're going to keep you updated on all the weather and all that good stuff, but I hope you are enjoying the sunshine while we have it, my friends. It's nice and warm out there. All that good stuff. Well, we've got lots to do today on the Wintrust Business Lunch, of course. We're talking to two women who have built and created really, really cool things. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking with Kara Green Epstein about her new film, Dragonfly, that was shot exclusively in Chicago and Minneapolis, and it's premiering tomorrow night in Chicago. So we will talk with her in just a bit. But right now, we're joined in studio by Dana Kay, who is the owner and publicist at Kay Publicity. She represents a lot of authors. She's worked with a ton of people, and she has just put her knowledge and expertise in one place and created a new book that is just now out, and it's called Your Book, Your Brand, A Step-by-Step Guide to Launching Your Book and Boosting Sales. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about this book and what prompted you to write it. It's you know, so much of your life, you know, your life's work that you do. You work with authors and you do so knowledgeably and so well. And was it just that you saw a need for the book to exist, or was it something else that prompted you?
There are a couple of things. You know, the first is that we receive queries from so many authors wanting us to help them with book promotion, social media consulting, and things like that. But not all of them can afford us, and not all of them are the right projects. Some people come too late to us. Sometimes we just don't have enough time in the calendar. And so I wanted to make sure I had a resource for them. I wanted to give them something. Even if we couldn't be their publicist, this would give them the tools they needed to successfully launch their book. I also do tons of speaking around the country, but again, I'm only one person. So it's a good tool for someone who couldn't attend my workshops or, you know, has never seen me speak again. It's all of the things I've taught in my workshop kind of downloaded into one book.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned that timeline and people coming to you a little bit too late. Is that a pretty common thing that people get all the way to the point where their book is about to come out and they're like, okay, I need help?
Oh my gosh. So often. Okay. So we love to work with people 6 to 7 months in advance, because a lot of monthly magazines, quarterly magazines, they're working on a 6 to 7 month lead time. So we're here in September and we're pitching for January issues of magazines already. And so if we get too close to publication, we just don't have enough time to ramp up the author's platform, get the pitches in. And there's some things that the author can do on their own, but it's kind of a straggle to the finish line. And I think a lot of authors don't realize what they need until maybe it's too late.
Yeah, yeah, that could be. What about, you know, I hear a lot from listeners on this station talking about the importance of their book clubs and the friendships and the communities they build, and how exciting it is when authors will take the time to connect with book clubs. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, I know it's shifted so much with social media, and I've seen that firsthand. I've seen that in a lot of different ways. I kind of feel like the kind of the virtual book club or the like the blog tour, that's kind of a newish still mm-hmm. thing that a lot of authors are starting to take advantage of.
You know, well, the common theme is people want connections, right? They would love to make a connection with the author. And so I do believe there's no substitution for meeting somebody in person. I mean, if an author goes to a book club and talks to 20 people who read their book, they're going to make connections that they simply won't make on social media. That being said, authors are more accessible than ever before. There's a conference going on in New Orleans called BoucherCon, and R.L. Stein is there. And there's all these people, the Goosebumps King, mm-hmm. and everyone gets to meet him. And everyone is expected to tour. Everyone's expected to do appearances. Everyone's expected to be on social media. And so the authors, you know, 10 years ago who you could only see if you went to the signing, now you can talk to them on Twitter. You can watch a video of them on YouTube. You can even interact and do a mm-hmm. tweet chat or a Facebook Live or something. And so everyone's so much more accessible. But at the same time, I honestly don't believe that the connections you make online can substitute the connections you make in person. I think doing community outreach, either from doing talks or visiting book clubs, or we have a lot of children's authors and young adult authors who do school visits. Mm-hmm. If you're an author and you go to a school, those students are going to remember you in a way that they won't if they just read your book.
Sure, sure, definitely. And I think that's an interesting thing that we've seen in a lot of industries, but particularly the creative ones, right? Where it used to be that the creator was a bit
protected from mm-hmm. from his or her readers or viewers or listeners or whatever, and there was almost an expectation that of success that was attached to that kind of inaccessibility. Like you'd made it when you had, you know, you had to go through someone's people.
Right.
But now it's kind of shifted. I think there's the expectation that you will be accessible and that you will have a two-way conversation with your readers or your viewers or, you know, whatever that is.
Yeah. I always think about, would Salinger be successful in the age of social media?
If J.D. Salinger had a Twitter account, that would be a great...
I don't know. I think he would just stop writing.
I think he would just go on Twitter rants, I think.
Maybe.
Well, and so we've also seen another shift in the publishing industry that I think is really interesting. And that's, it used to, or I think sometimes still is, the case where an author will do the work, write the book, and then go create a social media presence. Mm-hmm. But more and more now, we're seeing that social media presence first.
Sure.
Where people are building a blog and building their voice and then getting a book deal or getting, you know, things like that.
Yes, there's... Especially with nonfiction. If you're writing nonfiction, you have to have the platform. I couldn't have just come onto the literary scene and written this book. I have a company. I have a web presence. I have all of those readers built in. And so if you're writing nonfiction, you really need that platform in order to build your book. But in addition, you know, publishers are very risk averse. They want to know that something is going to work. They don't want to take a risk. So if they see someone has a huge blog presence or a huge social media following, they may be more inclined to give that person a book deal because they see that there is a built-in audience. We're working with an author, Jason Porath, who has Rejected Princesses, and it's all about Disney princesses who would never make it in and little known women in history.
I love it.
It's fantastic. So clever. But yeah, he had a web presence and he has a blog and he posts Rejected Princesses, and now he has the book, the collection, coming out at the end of October. But he built up that following first before going into publishing it.
I love that.
It's
Rejected
so
Princesses.
Good. I felt smarter and entertained at the same time when I was reading it.
That's what we want in our books. Mm-hmm. And so in your book in particular, what do you think most people will find most surprising upon reading it?
I think that there's a lot of misconceptions about social media. I think that a lot of publishers are telling authors, you got to be on social media, you got to be on social media. And I take the stance of, not everyone should be on social media, and you don't need every platform. And so I think that they may be surprised when the book is really not, these are all the things you have to do. The book is more, these are all the things that are possible, and this is how you can navigate which one is the best fit for you.
Mm-hmm.
I think also authors may be surprised at how it's pretty accessible. I think there's a misconception that publicists have the hidden contacts or the Rolodex of people, and the only way they can get onto radio shows or TV shows is through a publicist. And it's simply not true. If you do organic networking and write a good pitch email and note and reach out to the appropriate person, you don't need to be a publicist to get those media appearances.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that too. I think people psych themselves out and don't try to pitch sometimes.
Yes.
Like, no, pitch me. You're doing me a favor if you're bringing me a good story, you know?
Right. And knowing that there's someone on the other end of the email. You're
right.
Not sending an email out into the ether.
Right.
I mean, radio producers need to program their shows. Magazine editors need to fill those pages.
Absolutely.
It's a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. To back up a little, though, when you were talking about a lot of publishers with, you know, putting the expectation out of having, okay, you need to be on social media now, you're an author. I think too, there's maybe a beat of that's missing, and I think this is covered really well in your book, is that you can tell someone to be on social media, but then you need to tell them how to do it.
Right.
And that's a really important thing. I can't tell you how many authors I've seen that open a Pinterest account or Instagram and just pin or post pictures of their book.
Mm-hmm.
Like what am I supposed to do with it?
Or on the flip side, just post photos of like their breakfast and then their dinner and mm-hmm. then their lunch, and you know, there needs to be some sort of content strategy
Sure.
involved. And I think that authors are told what to do, but you're right, they are not told how to do it. And
Yeah.
there needs to be a lot more coaching. And we work with many authors, even if they're not our full-time clients, we do social media consulting and help them. But again, they're writers. Authors know how to write. It's just applying those writing skills to writing good content for social.
Right. So as we are, you know, looking out over the landscape of of what it takes to promote a book. And I think a lot of lessons in your book can probably be applied to other creative endeavors.
Absolutely.
For sure. But as you look at it, things have changed so rapidly just in the last 5 years in the way that you've approached. I mean, you know, the press release still matters, of course, but
sure.
But there's so many other things now. It used to just be send out a bunch of press releases and make contacts and you're done. And now there's so many other steps to that. So what do you think, or what are you starting to see signs of that maybe hint at what's next in the promotional world?
Well, first, it's funny that you say that, because the revision process of this book was so intense because the industry changes so rapidly.
So I was
getting final page proofs, which is supposed to be just dotting I's and crossing T's. But then I saw things like, you know, Goodreads used to not offer giveaway opportunities for ebooks. They rolled that out. And so now I want to change that. And then they started offering ebook deals. You know, there's things that change so rapidly. So I try to keep everything as up to date as possible. But even in this was a 6 month span, mm-hmm. and things had changed. So I see that. I would like to say that there's more long form content coming out there and more features. But honestly, I think everything is going shorter and shorter. Our attention spans are shorter. And so we're seeing YouTubers being just as influential as some of the TV mm-hmm. shows. We're seeing bookstagrammers, people on Instagram who take pretty photos of books with their coffee and their dog sometimes. And that's a branding strategy for the book and sending. So we don't only send books out to reviewers now, like to people at the radio stations or at the print publications. We're actually sending out to people on YouTube and to people on Instagram. So people aren't writing long form reviews. They're doing these short little photos or short vlogs, like a video blog. And so we're seeing everyone's attention span get a little shorter. I hope that's not indicative of books in general, because obviously books are 300, 400 pages.
Sure.
But I hope books are not replaced by video blogs. But we're seeing that the type of media coverage is catering to shorter attention spans.
And then how does that, considering that, how has that changed the way you approach a book tour for an author?
Well, I think that the days of doing the 15-city bookstore tour are really over. I think that we really focus on events where the author or the venue has a built-in audience. So if we're trying to plan events for an author, we'll start with where they live or where the book takes place or where they have a large community to gather ringers, essentially, for the event. But I think that there's also some other events around the country that have a large built-in audience. There's women's clubs, there's libraries. There's a great event here called at the Tuscan Market and Wine Bar in Arlington Heights. They have a 65-person book club.
Who knew?
The authors just go up, drink their wine, and answer people's questions. It's fantastic.
That's lovely. And Chicago especially. I feel like we are very lucky here. You know, we have so many literary events and so many live lit series, many of which we've talked about right here on the show, but there's literally something every night of the week.
Yes, which is good and bad, right? So it's really good that we have so much culture and so many things going on, but you're also competing for that. So any night of the week, if an author is doing a signing, they have to keep in mind they're competing with probably another signing across town, they're competing with music, they're competing with theater. And so it really takes a lot for people to get out of their house and get to an event. So when we're planning in-person events, we're really focusing on places that have a large built-in audience and aren't relying on the bookstore's mailing list or the bookstore's
sure.
social media presence. We also do a lot of joint events or panels. A lot of our young adult authors have toured together. And so having one author may not be the same draw as having three or four.
Sure, sure. Strength in numbers, absolutely. And so speaking of literary events and that kind of good stuff, where can people find your book and hear you talk about it next and all of that good stuff?
So we're having the Chicago launch event on Thursday, September 22nd at Mary's Attic in Andersonville. My colleague, an author friend, Loretta Nyhan, will be interviewing me, and books will be available for sale. It starts at 6. The interview will start at 7. And otherwise, the book will be out nationwide on September 20th on Tuesday.
Excellent. And we can all get it from All the usual places?
Yes, indie bookstores, Amazon, B&N, all that good stuff.
Excellent. And again, the name of the book, my friends, is Your Book, Your Brand, A Step-by-Step Guide to Launching Your Book and Boosting Sales. And that is by our good friend, Dana Kay. Well, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and be back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I am most grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Well, my friends, we have a very special guest in studio with us now. We're joined by filmmaker Kara Greene Epstein, and she has a really fabulous film that is premiering tomorrow night in Chicago, and I hope that you can all go to it. It will be at the Music Box Theater, which is a lovely, lovely theater. I'm a big fan of that place. But the film is called Dragonfly, and she is here to tell us all about it. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Amy.
Gladly. I thank you for coming in and visiting with us. So tell us about the film and kind of how you first had the idea for the film and how it came together.
Sure. So the film is about a struggling Chicago artist who goes home to help take care of her mom, who has early on Alzheimer's, and she is there to help her pack up her home, which is the home that she also grew up in. So she also brings home a lot of baggage with her from her childhood. So while she's packing up the house, she's unpacking that baggage. She's reconnecting with family friends, and she discovers some letters from a secret pen pal, Dragonfly, from her childhood. And she starts to wonder, who was that? You know, when she was 10, she never wondered. It just was magic. It was Dragonfly. But now she's really curious about, who was it who brought that magic to my life? And might that person be able to help rekindle my magic now?
Interesting. And I love that you have little dragonfly earrings on. It's all the theme you have going here with dragonflies. I love that. And, you know, another thing that is very cool and of note here is that you filmed entirely in Chicago and Minneapolis.
Yep, that was really important to us. So I grew up in Minneapolis and I live in Chicago now. And my co-director, Mary Beth Romslow, went to school in Chicago and she's from Iowa. And our executive producer, Mim Epstein, is also from Minneapolis. So we felt really strongly that we wanted to make a film in the Midwest and really show the coasts what is possible. And we had the most amazing crew and really wonderful cast using everybody who was here. So it was really a homegrown endeavor and exciting. And the story of how it began is so funny because it started on Facebook, as many good stories do these days. I had just moved to Chicago and had my second child and was feeling really, really stuck. Like I needed to move, like I needed to do something. I needed to start creating something on my own. Again, I was really feeling like I needed to do something like that. And so I posted on Facebook and I said, I know I should make a movie or a web series or a short film or something, but I don't know how to use a camera and I don't know how to tell someone how to use a camera. So there I said it and just put it in the world. Mm-hmm. And literally minutes later, I had a comment from my friend Mary Beth Romslow, who was an award-winning photographer turned documentary filmmaker who was interested in making narrative film. And she wrote, I think I know a girl who can help, you know, winky face.
Right.
And then we started talking and I pitched her this idea that I had and she liked it. And we wrangled in my sister-in-law, who happens to be a commercial producer in Minneapolis. And so the three of us started making this film, which was supposed to be a 10-minute short. And then as we kept developing the story, we realized we think this is a feature and can we do that? And as all great things do, I think you kind of oftentimes have to begin before you're ready and just trust that you will get there.
That's absolutely true.
And I think with any big project. And so we really did. We took what we knew and we were open to learning and we went out to assemble the best, you know, cast and crew we could on our little budget. And then we just kept learning along the way. We shot in the summer of 2014 into the fall of 2014. And then we also ran a Kickstarter, which I know you've done for some of your projects as well. And that was a huge undertaking and a production all its own. And Kickstarter and crowdfunding is such an interesting platform for business these days, which is fascinating and really magical in its own right and humbling. It's amazing to watch all of these people come out of the woodwork to support you and also to have an idea and to know that your idea connects with a lot of people. So that was exciting.
Yeah, I think the crowdfunding piece is always so interesting because it forces you to refine your idea every day, if not hourly. You have to constantly be rethinking, and it makes it better. It makes it so much stronger because you're constantly kicking the tires on what you're doing. And like you said, it almost is like you have, you know, 700 board members all of a sudden,
yes.
You know, all these people that, but in a very good way,
yes,
these
absolutely.
People that you owe an explanation. They've given you their hard earned money and
right.
they want action. They want it to work. They want it to, they're rooting for you, which I think is just such an interesting development that artists have now.
It is. And it's really wonderful because it is so empowering. Now that I had a Kickstarter, I've also become a Kickstarter supporter of a lot of other projects. And it's really empowering for me to be like, I can be a part of helping make these other visions come to life. So it doesn't always have to be my vision. And I can really pick and choose. It's an interesting consumer model because mm-hmm. I can say like, hey, I'm really interested in that. I want to watch that thing become reality because it's going to make my life better, or it's something that I'm interested in viewing or seeing. And my husband's become an addict of it now too. And so he'll always be like, oh, did you see what I backed on Kickstarter? We're getting this like corkscrew jump rope, whatever, you know, whatever it happens to be.
Right.
And I'm like, great. I didn't know you were into corkscrew jump roping, but that's fantastic.
Because he didn't know it existed until
that's
now.
Right.
It is. It's like a hobby. It's like this strange little,
yeah.
It's like a almost like a video game kind of thing. You just like get in there and you just start backing things that will make your life better.
Right.
Most of mine are connected to a lot of, oh, why didn't I think of that? I'm gonna back them.
Right.
I'm gonna do a lot of that.
Right.
All right, my friends, we're talking with the creator of the film Dragonfly. It premieres tomorrow night in Chicago. We'll be right back in just a bit to continue this conversation here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. I'm most grateful to you for that. My friends, we have a very special guest in studio with us today. We are hanging out with filmmaker Kara Green-Epstein. She has created a film called Dragonfly, and it is premiering tomorrow night right here in Chicago. It was filmed in Chicago and Minneapolis, so we've got crazy Midwest love for this film, and she's here talking about the film with us. And, you know, another aspect of the film that I think is really interesting, Kara, is that you've partnered with the Alzheimer's Association, and you're giving back through ticket sales. Tell us about how that came about and how all that even works.
Sure. So that's really important to us, that that the film be more than just an opportunity to make a movie, that it has a larger reach. The mother in the film has early onset Alzheimer's, and I work with Memory Ensemble. So I work with an ensemble of 8 adults who have Alzheimer's disease through the Cognitive Neuroscience and Alzheimer's Disease Center at Northwestern Hospital and the Looking Glass Theater. So that's a collaboration that we have. So that's a personal connection for me. Mary Beth, our director, her grandmother had Alzheimer's. And so we had always planned on reaching out to the Alzheimer's Association. And then the Minnesota chapter heard about us before we reached out. And they reached out to us and said, would you be interested in partnering? And we moved from there to meeting with the Greater Illinois chapter. And we're just really thrilled to be able to give back with a portion of the ticket sales and also help raise awareness about Alzheimer's. Our film is not Still Alice. Alzheimer's is a piece of it, but it's not an Alzheimer's disease film. And it deals with the beginning of Alzheimer's as opposed to the end. So I think it takes a different twist on it and takes hopefully takes audiences on a different emotional journey into it, which I think is such an important piece of beginning to understand the disease and how frustrating it can be.
Certainly. And what was that involvement like during the process of creating the film, partnering with the charity?
You know, when we were creating the film, we didn't have the partnership yet. So it was really just trying to tap into our own experiences, tap into the experiences of friends who had family members with Alzheimer's, and then through my work with Memory Ensemble, trying to be true to how many different individuals I was seeing as opposed to a group of Alzheimer's patients, but really smart, amazing professionals. We have a doctor, we have an attorney, we have a social worker. One of our ensemble members was a private detective for years. So these are incredibly professional, proud people with a lot going for them that have been affected by this disease. And so it's not It's not a poor me victim kind of a film. And Claire, the character who has that, doesn't feel that way. She is very much like, I'm going to be in charge of my life as long as I can, make my own decisions as long as I can before I'm robbed of that ability. And so she has a very proactive approach, which is juxtaposed against her daughter, who's the lead character, who is kind of more passive. And she plays more of a victim role in their relationship. And she feels like things have always happened to her. And so watching them on that X and Y axis and finding out where they're going to overlap is an exciting piece of the movie. It's what
certainly
I like. Yeah.
And I think it's really critical that you chose early onset. I think that's a really important time. That's something that's touched my family too. And I think there's a lot of angst around that time of not only, I think, a little bit of stigma still. I think there's, you know, certainly the case in my family, trying to kind of talk yourself out of that being the case. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's can't be that. It can't, you know,
right.
I think there's a, and when we talk about it mostly in the main narrative, I think it's usually much further down the road. And so I think it's very, very important that you've tackled this at such a critical moment in the disease progression. So that's really excellent. Another issue that you have tackled in this film that I think is really fascinating. Certainly we talk about women and the workplace a lot on this show. And when you compare your set to the average Hollywood set, you're putting a lot of people to shame. And so talk to me about that, because you seem to have actually achieved gender parity on your film set.
We have actually achieved gender parity. We have true gender equity on and off screen for the Dragonfly cast and crew, 50% men, 50% women. When Mim and Mary Beth and I started this, we didn't go off saying this is going to be a women's film. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but we looked around and we just happened to be three women at the helm of a feature film. And then we looked at the numbers and we said, wow, this almost never happens. And then we got connected to this really cool network of female filmmakers. We got really lucky early on. We had a connection to the screenwriter of Fair Goes Bang, which is Mira Menon's first film. Right now she has Equity that's out. Mm-hmm. And so we talked to them about what was that process like. And then we were just really dedicated to making sure that we were providing opportunity to the best people possible. And I think that one of the things that happens, that just happens naturally, is when you're a woman, you know lots of women. So we knew a lot more people and they knew a lot more people who would be good for our crew. And similarly, we found some amazing men to work on our crew, and they knew great men and women as well. And then when we looked at the numbers at the end of the day, we said, we did this. This is 50-50 and this is pretty freaking awesome and not hard. Mm-hmm. It was not challenging. We didn't have to like get binders full of women, you know, and right. and go through them to try and find the women to fill these roles. They were there and awesome. Our assistant director, our production designer, you know, writer, executive producer, director, the three leads of the film. These were not things that we were scraping the bottom of the barrel to try and make sure that we could say we're 50-50. And then we also have some really wonderful and very accomplished men on our film. Our DP, Marcus Taplin, was a baby when he did our film. I know he's going to hate that when he listens to this, but he was, you know, maybe all of 24. Mm-hmm. And he just does a beautiful job with this. And our entire crew was really wonderful. And the Midwestern work ethic was so apparent. I had a couple of people come in from LA to just help advise. And one of them was a good friend of mine from grad school. And he was staying with me. And he would just say, I can't believe the joy and the work ethic that people are coming to work with every day. Everyone is kind and respectful to each other. And it is not taking away from the work. It was adding to it. I think that bad behavior is often used as an excuse. Well, the work is great. And that's what's necessary to get the work done. And we're so proud of the fact that we made this film. It looks like $1 million. We made it for less than $100,000. We only shot 17 days. And everyone was nice and respectful and had skin in the game and came up, showed up, did their job, did their best work. And that was really possible. And we have a great community of people now. One of the things that we did the first day of set actually is something that I learned in the theater. In addition to having a table read so that everyone could meet each other, because often you don't on film, mm-hmm. We had the crew circle up the first day and everyone went around and said, why are they doing this? Because there's so many people who are working for a fraction of what they're worth. What did they hope to get out of this experience and why were they doing it? And that was a really great guidepost and guiding light to have throughout production, throughout the process.
I love that. I love that so much. And I keep saying this. I think that Hollywood should be nervous. I think I feel like the Midwest, we're cooking up a lot of stuff here.
We are cooking up a lot of stuff here.
And it's really, I mean, earlier in the program, we were talking with Dana Kay, who works with authors, and just more and more I see people, we no longer have to run to the coast to get good work done.
Yeah.
And in fact, people are choosing to be here and thriving. And it's really, really great to see these really wonderful creative projects coming out of this wonderful city.
Yeah, and it's so pretty. You know, that's the other thing. Our film is really pretty, which I love. And Chicago just looks beautiful in it. And, you know, sitting here in the studio with you and looking at Chicago, I mean, it's such an exciting backdrop for film. And the Midwest is really exciting. We do a road trip in the film from Chicago to Minneapolis. And so you get to see the farmland of Wisconsin and you get to go over the St. Croix River. And it's really exciting to say this is not just flyover country. There are bustling urban metropolises that are here. There are really dynamic artists who are here. And we're here to stay and we got something to say.
Nice. I love it. So tomorrow night is the premiere at Music Box, and it's also gone to some other festivals.
Yes.
And then a little bit later in the year, you have other milestones you'll be hitting with the film.
So we're finishing up our festival run now, and we've been really lucky. We've played coast to coast, and we've won some awards, which has been really exciting. And after tomorrow night, 7 o'clock at the Music Box, then the film goes to North Carolina for another film festival there, the Foot Candle Film Festival. We'll probably play a few more, and then we will be on Amazon by the end of the year. And so you can find us there, and on Vimeo Direct, you can also find us there, and you'll be able to order DVDs. So we'll be there for the holidays.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right, my friends, I will also tweet out, if you find me on Twitter or Facebook, I will be sure and post information about the event tomorrow night at Music Box. I know I will be there, and it would be super if you were there too to support this really excellent film. Kara, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Amy.
All right, my friends, we will be right back in just a bit on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.